Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The First Philosophers, The Pre-Socratics and Sophists by Robin Waterfield, narrated by Adrian Hobart. Publisher's note, this audiobook contains references to material present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. So much of our information about the pre-Socratic philosophers and the sophists is fragmentary or otherwise obscure that the temptation was to write a book in which the amount of commentary outweighed the amount of translated material. I have resisted this temptation. After a short introduction, each thinker has been allowed to speak as much as possible for himself, or, failing that, at least to be heard, however faintly at times, through the work of ancient commentators. There is a great deal of secondary ancient material, especially about the pre-Socratics, whose importance was generally recognised in ancient times. It is therefore well beyond the scope of a book such as this to hope for completeness. Rather, my policy has been to translate the majority of the actual fragments themselves and a small proportion of the ancient testimonia, concentrating on those passages which are both important and relatively clear in their own right, so as to continue to let the thinkers speak for themselves as much as possible, and which seems to me to be relatively faithful to the original thinker, or at least to make it plain that they are distorting him, and how they are doing so. A few scholars are perhaps over-pessimistic about our chances of recovering the thought of the pre-Socratics and sophists. In some cases, we have enough genuine fragments to test the validity of the secondary testimonia. In some cases, the material surrounding shorter fragments can cast light on the original context. Nevertheless, there is an immense amount of discussion among modern scholars about what each of these thinkers really thought. Naturally, scholars prefer to rely as much as possible on the actual fragments themselves, but in the case of none of these first Western philosophers, are there ever quite enough of these for us to be able to see the whole picture? In addition, a lot of the fragments are devilishly obscure. The most unsatisfactory aspect of writing this book has been the need to omit a great deal of the scholarly arguments and counter-arguments which support certain conclusions. But whole books have been written about, say, Heraclitus, Parmenides, and Empedocles. How can one compress the evidence and the deductions from the evidence into 20 or so pages? But that is the necessary policy of this book, and in order to keep to it, I have appended longer bibliographies, found in the print and ebook versions of the book, than a volume like this might usually warrant. In the case of the pre-Socratics and sophists, reference to modern works is indispensable, since many listeners will want further guidance. However, let me urge listeners to start studying these thinkers simply by thinking for themselves about what any of them might have been meaning. For all the scholarly work that has gone into the area, there is little consensus. Your own ideas, based firmly on the available evidence as presented in this book, are as good a way into the thought of the first philosophers as those of the most eminent of academic scholars. The strategy necessarily adopted in this book, of assigning each thinker his own section, works satisfactorily in the case of the pre-Socratics, but not quite so well in the case of the sophists. It helps to show that they were individual thinkers, not members of a school, but a great deal of material that it would be right to call sophistic is embedded in occasional contexts in the other 5th century writers, especially the historians, Hippocratics, and dramatists, all reflected in 4th century literature, especially Plato. In the case of the sophists, then, I strongly recommend supplementing this book by reading the thematic approach to the movement adopted by, say, Guthrie, 10, Volume 3, or Kerford, 97. Introduction. In the last stanza of The Gods of Greece by Friedrich von Schiller, 1759 to 1805, the poet laments the passing of the old gods. Yes, home they went, and all things beautiful. All things high they took with them, all colours, all the sounds of life, and for us remained only the de-souled word. torn out of the time flood, they hover, saved on the heights of Pindus. What shall live immortal in song, in life is bound to go under. The poem perfectly sums up a particular attitude, a romantic attitude that at some point mythos was replaced by logos, the desouled word, although for reasons that will become clear later. This is not an attitude with which I wholly agree. It does serve as a useful launching point for discussion. The Greek word logos covers a wide range of meanings. It can mean account, in the sense either of story, or of amount, or value, as in, he is of no account. It can mean word, or speech, or argument. It can mean proportion, principle, or formula. It can mean reason, both in the sense of the human rational faculty, and in the sense of explanation. In short, it covers a nest of what we might call logical and rational faculties and activities. What Schiller meant then was that at some point in history, our emotional and intuitive side lost out to such desouled activities. Schiller's view is also commonly reflected, though not as an occasion for romantic mourning, in the standard histories of philosophy. The fact that both romantics and academics are saying the same thing constitutes a fascinating case where a truce has apparently been declared in what Plato described as the ancient quarrel between poetry and philosophy. Republic, 607b. Time and again, in both abstruse academic tomes and more popular histories, we read how a revolution took place in the ancient Greek world and how its first manifestations arose at the beginning of the 6th century BCE. The thinkers associated with this revolution are known collectively as the pre-Socratic philosophers, pre-Socratic because they preceded Socrates in thought, even if the last of them are his contemporaries in time, and they are said to have invented philosophy and science for the Western world. Here, for instance, is a quotation from an influential history. But no uniform picture emerges from all these Egyptian and Babylonian achievements, nor do the separate details coalesce to form a single body of scientific thought grounded in an all-inclusive philosophical doctrine. This had to wait for that scientific approach to the study of nature, which was the creation of the Greeks in the 6th century. This approach took the form of an attempt to rationalize phenomena and explain them within the framework of general hypotheses. The object aimed at was giving general validity to the experience obtained from regarding the world as a single orderly unit, a cosmos, the laws of which can be discovered and expressed in scientific terms. The fame of the pre-Socratics has endured well. Even those who are not aware of them as a group have heard of the obscure aphorisms of Heraclitus, or of Zeno's paradoxes, or of the number mystic Pythagoras. But in this book we shall meet others, Thales, Anaximenes, and Anaximander, all from the city of Miletus in Asia Minor, down the coast from Heraclitus's hometown, Ephesus, Xenophanes of Colophon, another town in Asia Minor, Parmenides of Elea, or Velia, in southern Italy, the first pre-Socratic to start a recognisable school of thought, whose first and most important members were his fellow Eleatic Zeno and Melissus from the island of Samos, where Pythagoras too had been born, though he lived half his life in southern Italy, Empedocles of Acragas in Sicily, Anaxagoras of Clazomenae in Asia Minor, Democritus of Abdera on the coast of northern Greece, Diogenes from Apollonia on the west coast of the Black Sea. They all lived between about 600 and 400 BCE. Socrates, by comparison, lived from 469 to 399. The last of the pre-Socratics were Socrates' contemporaries, as were the earliest sophists, whose thought is also covered in this book. The work of none of the pre-Socratics or the sophists remains in its entirety. We have to rely on fragments preserved in later writers and reports about their thought. Some of these reports were written by thinkers with their own agendas, who were implicitly or explicitly unsympathetic or even hostile to the pre-Socratics. Others are the barest summaries of complex views, which often reveal a high degree of incomprehension. Unfortunately, distortion was the name of the game. While we owe an incalculable debt to Aristotle, his pupil Theophrastus, and their successors for preserving discussions of the pre-Socratics, it has now been established beyond the shadow of a doubt that they viewed their predecessors almost entirely through the lenses of their own philosophies. Here is a single notorious instance. Aristotle believed that in order to gain an overall perspective on anything, one had to ask four questions about it. What is it made of? What is its origin? What is its purpose? What is its form or appearance? In Aristotelian language, answering the first question gives us the material cause of a thing, then the efficient cause, the final cause, and the formal cause. When he surveyed his earliest pre-Socratic predecessors, he found them saying something, let us for the moment leave it as vague as possible, about certain material elements, such as water or fire. He found it impossible to resist the idea that they were talking about his material cause, that they were talking about what things were made of. Look then at T8 on pages 12 to 13, in which Aristotle discusses Thales. It is clear that he is, however tentatively, claiming that Thales said that everything was made out of water. But is this the case? It is more likely that Thales said that everything started in water, or rests on water, or something like that. There are precedents for either idea in Egyptian or Near Eastern mythology. Or, here is another example. Aristotle has quite high praise for Anaxagoras, famously describing him at one point as like a sober man compared to his babbling predecessors. Metaphysics 984b 17-18, and elsewhere in the same book as quite up to date in his thinking, 986b6. But these words of praise are reserved for Anaxagoras only because Aristotle thought that Anaxagoras had intuited certain elements of his own theories. Instead of just talking about the material cause, as his predecessors had done, Aristotle thought that, in introducing mind as a motivating factor, Anaxagoras had also introduced an efficient cause, and so had made a considerable advance on his predecessors. To be fair to Aristotle, he does not disguise the fact that he is presenting a partial picture of his predecessors. He announces his program close to the beginning of metaphysics. Let's take those who are engaged in the study of these matters before us and were concerned to speculate and seek after the truth. For it is clear that they too mention certain first principles and causes. The consideration of their work will also be of some help in our present inquiry, in the sense that either we will discover some other kind of cause, or we will have more confidence in the four I have just mentioned. 983b 1-6. In other words, Aristotle makes no bones about the fact that he is studying his pre-Socratic predecessors only in order to shed light on his own theory of four causes. Aristotle's pupil, Theophrastus, was even more important in the history of philosophy. The doxographers, the names scholars give to the writers who summarized and discussed the views of earlier thinkers, all depend ultimately on a largely lost book by Theophrastus called The Opinions of the Natural Scientists. Just occasionally, however, we can check what he said against the original. The results are not encouraging. We have not only his account of Plato's theory of the senses, but also Plato's original statements. It is clear that the degree of distortion is extreme. We cannot have confidence that our ancient secondary sources have placed the ideas of their pre-Socratic predecessors within the right context in any single case. Of course, they might have done in a few cases, but we simply cannot be sure. And sometimes the possibility of distortion is plain to see. Not only is the Aristotelian bias of Theophrastus, as well as of Aristotle himself, obvious, but we can often detect Stoic or Christian bias in later doxographers. Then many of the doxographers were living hundreds of years after the thinkers covered in this volume, and may not have had access to the original writings, but were relying on someone else's epitome. Similar distortions have spoiled the record of the Sophists as well, due in this case not to Aristotle so much as to Plato. One of the avowed purposes of Plato's early dialogues was to defend the memory of his mentor, Socrates. This was a name he shared with Xenophon and other Socratic writers. He did this by distinguishing him sharply from the Sophists, to the detriment of the latter, who appear as mercenary and as unconcerned with either logical truth or psychological benefit. At the same time, Plato wanted to delineate the domain and methods of what he saw as philosophy, and to this end he felt impelled to disparage the work of those with rival educational claims, the orators, poets, and above all, the Sophists. Xenophon succinctly displays the typical prejudice of the Socratics against the Sophists towards the end of his treatise, On Hunting. What surprises me about the Sophists, as they are called, is that although most of them profess to educate young men in virtue, they actually do exactly the opposite. It is not just that we have never seen a man become good thanks to the Sophists of today, their writings are also not designed to improve people. Much of their writing is concerned with trivia, which can give young men vain enjoyment but not virtue. To read it in the hope of learning something is a pointless waste of time. Their treatises keep people from doing something useful and teach them things that are offensive. These are serious criticisms, but then the issue is serious. As regards the content of their treatises, my charge is that while they have gone to great lengths over style, they have eliminated the kind of sound views which educate the younger generation in virtue. Recovering the thought of the Sophists is also hampered by the fact that Aristotle clearly regarded few, if any of them, as serious thinkers who deserved his attention. This in turn meant that no doxographic tradition arose in the case of the Sophists as it did for the pre-Socratics. Apart from a very few original fragments, Plato is our chief source of information, and as already remarked, he is not a reliable source. The pre-Socratics as scientists. The idea that these thinkers collectively brought something new into the world, a scientific or proto-scientific attitude, a reliance on logos, is too simple and broad a picture. It is in fact rather naive to lump all the pre-Socratics together, as if they were somehow identical, although it has been a tendency in the history of philosophy from Aristotle onwards. Nevertheless, it is clear that not all the people standardly classified as pre-Socratic philosophers fit comfortably into the Aristotelian mould. They range from shamans like Empedocles, through mystics like Pythagoras, and prophets like Heraclitus, to metaphysicians such as Parmenides, philosophers such as Anaxagoras, and proto-scientists like the Milesians and Atomists. To describe Empedocles as a shaman or Heraclitus as a prophet is not to say that they could not make valuable contributions towards scientific or philosophical debate, but it is to say that their emphases and experiences are not those of a complete scientist or philosopher. But despite the variety of interests the pre-Socratics display, there is something common to them all. Starting with the broad picture, we should ask what is meant by the claim that they invented philosophy and or science. Strictly, one should distinguish between those like the Milesians, who brought something scientific into the world, and those like Parmenides or perhaps Heraclitus, who reflected upon their predecessors' scientific work and were therefore philosophers. We need first an example of the kind of cosmological work they were doing. Anaximenes of Miletus is typical of the earliest Milesian phase of pre-Socratic thought, and is fairly easy to summarize, without undue distortion. Anaximenes said that the prime matter of the universe was air, and that this could be condensed or rarefied into the various components of the universe. When rarefied, it becomes hot and fiery, and forms not just fire itself, but also the fiery heavenly bodies. When condensed, it becomes cold and can be seen as water, and ultimately earth. These four elements form the concentric layers of the universe. Air is and always was in motion, and it was presumably this motion which in some way initiated the process of condensation and rarefaction. Of course, having thought up the twin processes of condensation and rarefaction, Anaximenes might just as well have said that water or one of the other elements was the prime constituent of things, but he chose air because it is apparently all-pervading and can appear to be indefinite, and because we breathe it in and it causes life in us. Our soul is air. The earth and all the heavenly bodies are flat, he said, and float gently on the air like leaves. So, were Anaximenes and his peers scientists? What does it take to be a scientist? Above all, in today's terms, it takes scientific reasoning, that is, adherence to the scientific method. Paraphrasing Aristotle, whose formulation of the scientific method is as good as any, and better than most, we can describe this as a method of both induction and deduction, or of resolution and composition, as the medieval schoolmen used to call them. The scientist, unless he is a follower of Karl Popper, starts with observation of an event. By a process of induction, he reaches explanatory principles. From these principles, facts about the event in question, and about related phenomena, are then to be deduced. Of course, it is not that simple. It takes a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between observation and theory, refining and correcting both observations and hypotheses. But in this way, the scientist has progressed from uncomprehending observation of an event to understanding why the event is as it is. From observation of the pretty spectrum of colours displayed on the wall, he has progressed to understanding that light is in fact composed of rays with different refractive properties. In other words, scientific reasoning is a combination of forming testable hypotheses to account for observed phenomena. This may take imagination and model-making as well as logic, and of testing and retesting these hypotheses by experimentation and logic. The resulting hypothesis should explain the observed phenomena in as simple a way as possible, should allow one to predict the behaviour of related phenomena, and should cohere with the body of accepted scientific theories and doctrines. Throughout, everything should be quantifiable, measurable, and testable as far as is possible, within the limitations of the technology currently available. There is absolutely no indication that the pre-Socratics were scientists in this sense. There is little sign that they undertook experimentation at all. The hypotheses they came up with about the world's formation and constitution were not testable by scientific means. Where observation and theory clashed, they invariably preferred theory to observation. They were, in short, dogmatists, not experimental scientists. Of course, it is not entirely fair to criticize the pre-Socratics for lack of experimentation. After all, a great deal of what interested them was not capable of empirical testing in their day. But that, in itself, helps to show that they should not be described as scientists in the modern sense of the word. Even the more scientific relatives of the pre-Socratics, the Hippocratic doctors, who started working sometime in the latter half of the 5th century, tended to use experiment and observation not to test one of their own theories, but either to corroborate a theory or to refute an opponent's theory. Also, the subject of their few experiments is rarely the thing itself, the part of the body they are concerned with, but something outside the body, which is supposed to have the same properties as the thing itself inside the body. In other words, simile and analogical thinking rule, as when Empedocles compares human breathing to the action of a device for gathering liquid, or when Anaximenes compares lightning to the phosphorescence of water at night cleaved by an oar. Here are two famous and typical early examples of experimentation. At On Celestial Phenomena 358b to 359a, Aristotle tries to support his view that seawater is a mixture of ingredients by describing an experiment in which a wax bottle is let down into seawater. When it is recovered, fresh water is found in it, and Aristotle concludes that the fresh water was percolated through the wax. From this we can conclude either that he never did the experiment himself, but was relying on hearsay, or that the water in the jar came about through condensation. In either case, he was way off the mark. Again, at Ayres, Waters, Places, 18, preserved in the corpus of works attributed to Hippocrates, the author wants to demonstrate that freezing causes the lightest and finest parts of water to dry up and disappear. He left a bowl of water outside to freeze. When it was thawed again afterwards, he claimed, there was less water than there was originally. From this we can conclude that either some of the water evaporated or was drunk by animals, or he applied heat to thaw the ice and so boiled some away. What evidence do scholars have for their view that the pre-Socratics, or some of them, were scientists? Here we come to what we may call scientific attitudes, as distinct from scientific reasoning or method. A short list of scientific attitudes would consist of the following. 1. The optimistic assumption that the world and its components are comprehensible. This is what Einstein was getting at when he said, God may be subtle, but he is not malicious. 2. The assumption that the human rational mind is the correct tool for understanding the world. 3. Adherence to a particular set of approaches to problem solving. This involves, for instance, analysing problems into their component parts, and then dealing separately with those parts, and starting with simple problems before tackling more complex ones. 4. Tempered curiosity. Although curiosity about the world is essential for the scientist, it must not be allowed to lead the investigator into hasty hypotheses or extravagant leaps of the imagination, nor be governed by prejudice in any form. 5. A love of and facility with abstract concepts. This is where the pre-Socratics fit in. Some or all of them display at least some of these attitudes. It would, of course, be unreasonable to expect them to be fully-fledged scientists in the modern sense of the word, but perhaps their adherence to, even invention of, at least some of these scientific attitudes is enough to justify our calling them at least proto-scientists. They tend to fall at the hurdle of tempered curiosity. That is, they tend to rush into what modern scientists would undoubtedly call wild and even visionary speculation. But they were the first to make and explore the consequences of the assumption, which is absolutely crucial to the development of science, that the human rational mind is the correct tool for understanding the world. They were reductionists. That is, they formed general hypotheses in an attempt to explain as many things as possible by means of as few hypotheses as possible. And in their theorizing, they relied on natural phenomena like air, rather than supernatural phenomena like the traditional Greek gods and goddesses. However, this broad picture must immediately be qualified by the reminder that the pre-Socratics, some more than others, retained a strong streak of what can only be called mystical thought. Given the current opposition between reason and irrationality, it is one of the ironies of history that science developed out of partly irrational roots, the kind of cosmology and cosmogony that the Ionians, the Three Milesians and Xenophanes were led to construct with the help of their scientific attitudes, then came to be criticised by Parmenides, and if some scholars are right, by Heraclitus, before being reinstated ingeniously by the Neo-Ionians, who followed the Eleatics. But in all its phases, pre-Socratic thought was holistic. It was an attempt to give a systematic account of the whole known universe and all its major features. The pre-Socratics and their predecessors. Can it really be said that the pre-Socratics were the first to assume that the human rational mind is the correct tool for understanding the world? Did people before the pre-Socratics not think, not use their brains? In what sense did the predecessors of the pre-Socratics not have or make use of logos? In the history of ideas, it is always specious to divide things into a before and an after. It is not...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?